Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Wickens against Shell Oil, and we will hear from Mr. Babb.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Your Honor, this case presents two questions. First, when is the purpose of Section 8 of Indiana's Underground Storage Tank Act satisfied? And second, at what point do attorney misrepresentations to the court and an opposing party justify vacating an award in Section 8's unique context? This court should reverse the trial court's fee award because Shell agreed to contribute to the corrective action costs of remediating this property before January 9th of 2007, thus fulfilling the USTA's purpose.
It seems to me that that first question that you pose is one that depends very much on the district court's assessment of the facts of how various discussions, various undertakings are going forward. And if that's the case, then it seems to me that this court owes quite a bit of deference to the district court's assessment of the situation.
Your Honor, I would agree. It is clearly a mixed question of law and fact. With respect to the operative facts, those aren't in doubt. I mean, the judge clearly found that on July 15th of 2005, Shell agreed to remediate the property and respond to IDEM.
I hate to use the word clearly in a situation like this, and I don't think that that's actually an accurate summary of what happens at that earliest date.
Your Honor, it's
go back to saying that it seems to me the district court has to make an assessment of the underlying facts, like what are you really offering to do, what's the situation. And on top of that, the district court needs to make an assessment of the question whether it's still productive to allow the parties to complete settlement discussions, particularly in a case like this where the statute permits attorney's fees and costs. I don't need to tell you that settlements normally would include some kind of agreement about that. So I get back to the sense that there's no doubt that this district court was not satisfied that the parties had really resolved everything until that January 9th cutoff date.
Well, Your Honor, the judge identified the correct legal principle. She said, and this is on the short appendix at 45, that fee shifting should end when, quote, the efforts of counsel are no longer directed towards obtaining contribution from Shell. And so really the question becomes, what is a contribution claim? Because that's the purpose of the statute. The judge...
But Shell was making all sorts of fusses about this other property, and one doesn't find out until you read the rest of the record that there was a lot of scientific evidence in the record suggesting that if, to the extent the Gardner property was contaminated at all, it's because of migration from Shell's old tanks, not the other way around. I mean, there's a lot of factual messiness here, and I think, you know, if one accepts that scientific approach to the case, then Shell really had an obligation to remediate everything. Shell kept trying to say, no, not this, not that, let's define something here.
The problem with the statute, Your Honor, is that you have a piece of litigation that's going on simultaneously with an IDEM investigation. To this day, there hasn't been a final determination by IDEM as to who is responsible for the property and in what amount. It's still that nothing has moved forward. IDEM has limited resources. And what you have is, for this particular issue, you look at what the relief that they sought. Here's his count one. They sought, quote, a contribution to the corrective action costs pursuant to Section 8. Now, we know from the Indiana Supreme Court's decision in 2008 and the Flans decision, they were talking about what is a contribution claim.
And is why the district court cuts it off at January 7th, and which is why you're in the position of cross-appellee on the remainder of Mr. Shear's claims.
Correct, Your Honor, but she cut it off at January 9th of 2007 because she said at that point the efforts of counsel were no longer aimed at receiving a contribution from Shell. And here's the legal issue, Your Honor, and here's the reason why it's an error as a matter of law. She assumed that contribution is 100% contribution. It is not. A contribution is, if we're all PRPs at one point, potentially responsible parties, but I convince somebody, or you acknowledge that you're responsible for that part of the contamination, whatever I&M is going to assess it to be, that's the purpose of the statute. This is not an Article 30 environmental legal action where you're maybe trying to clean the whole thing up. You were trying to, at a point, get somebody to acknowledge, I will contribute to the cost of this. That's the plain language of the statute.
And that's where I get back to the facts of the case. Her assessment of the way the facts are developing is that the contamination on the Wickens' property, and for that matter on the Gardner property as well, came from Shell's underground storage tanks.
That was one possibility, Your Honor. To this day, we still don't know if it was the heating oil tanks. There were heating oil tanks on this property that might have, in fact, used these tanks.
The district court judge, though, makes the assessment that there isn't particularly good evidence that it's anything but Shell's underground storage tanks.
Your Honor, at that point in time, that's true, but the I&M investigation has not gone on yet. And the way that the statute used to originally work...
But we're focusing on a settlement, number one, and we're focusing on attorney's fees in conjunction with that settlement. If Shell had wanted to litigate the question of how much contribution it needed to pay, 80%, 90%, 2%, you know, whatever it was, litigation was an option. But you settled the underlying liability for your contribution, correct word, on this. And so now the question is, at what point, you know, how much attorney's fees are payable? And if your contribution should have been at the 100% level or the 89% level or whatever, then that sets up the attorney's fees issue.
But Your Honor, here's the problem with that analysis. The problem is this, is that you have a piece of litigation that has begun. You have an ongoing I&M investigation, and nobody really knows who's responsible for what. And so under that theory of law, Your Honor, you can literally begin the investigation. You can continue to ask for 100% contribution, wholesale indemnification, stigma damages, everything. They're all clearly non-USTA claims, and you can use the threat of that and not settling for it to continue this case to get to a $500,000 level. That can't be the purpose of the statute.
But I just want to be careful about the indemnification point, because you're quite right. This is not an indemnification statute, and so to use a hypothetical, if the Wickenses sold their property to somebody, to buyer, and they, in their contract of sale, promised buyer that the land is not contaminated because it's been remediated or it was never contaminated, whatever they say, there's a contractual provision. And then buyer discovers that it is. The Wickenses might be called upon to indemnify. USTA is not about that kind of claim. We all understand that. But if Shell's proportional responsibility for the contamination is 100%, that's a contribution claim. That's not indemnification. It's not based on contract. It's not based on tort. It's based on this statute.
But Your Honor, the statute, there's nowhere in the statute, you can't look at the plain language of the statute and get to the result that the purpose of this statute is to get somebody committed to 100% contribution. That is not what the statute says. The statute
says... Not even if they're 100% responsible?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but we're not there yet. We don't even know the item investigation.
Settled the case. So I take it your position is that at the moment in time that Shell said we're willing to contribute something, even if it's 1%, fees cut off at that point. Is that your position?
Correct, Your Honor.
How does that make sense if the ultimate result of the case is that you settle for 100%? So you're saying that nothing that the lawyer and the party does to get from the 1% to 100% counts?
Your Honor, that doesn't make
any sense.
They settle for 100% because they had no choice.
Well, we're not here to question the underlying reason for the settlement. I mean, we don't have your clients here to question them about that. The fact is they settled the case at 100%, and it got better after the point in time that you're talking about should be the cutoff time.
But, Your Honor,
for the plaintiff, I mean.
The reason why they were able to essentially force Shell into a settlement is Shell had no choice in the matter. Because what you have is simultaneously while you're trying to litigate this case and you've got your own consultants battling with our consultants, you ultimately have a determination by I&M that's going to determine who is ultimately going to be liable for it. That's the unfortunate thing about this case.
Well, maybe that's a reason to say that the statute should be revisited by the Indiana legislature, but we're not dealing with the I&M investigation here. We're dealing with a private lawsuit that your client chose to settle at 100% responsibility. I just don't see how it makes sense that that what it takes to get there isn't recoverable, number one, and I'm still having a hard time seeing what the legal question is here. I think that this is a purely factual assessment by the district judge of when something happened or something got accomplished.
But Your Honor, any time you're under a fee-shift analysis for a statute, you ask yourself, when is the purpose of the statute satisfied? I mean, clearly the purpose of the statute couldn't be satisfied when you just keep asking more and more and more and more. And Shell says, well, look, there's no doubt about it that this Gardner property was a potential responsible party. I mean, it was a gas station that was across the street. And so early on, Shell says, look, we'll contribute to remediate the property and respond to IDEM. How can that not be the statutory purpose of the purpose of the statute? If you look at the Indiana Court of Appeals decision, here's what it says about the USTA. Liability under the USTA depends upon whether a person owned or operated the UST from which the release occurred during the time when the release occurred. Nothing more is required to find liability under the USTA. And so it is a big deal to come in and say, look, we're in. We'll respond to whatever item tells us to. And we know from the Flan decision that that's ultimately going to be a cleanup obligation assessed by IDEM at some point. It's a very unique statute where the IDEM process is going forward. And, in fact, to this day, they're still not out of stage one in the IDEM process. Nobody knows who's ultimately responsible for this contamination. Now, we know that Shell is because of things that relate to the second part of the argument where there was this undisclosed funding source that Shell didn't know about. But, Your Honor, every time we shift fees under a statute, we ask, is the purpose of the statute satisfied? And, Your Honor, when you come in, it's a big deal. When you say, I'm in, I'm willing to contribute, I just don't know what the responsibility is ultimately going to be. What other purposes serve? And here's for an example. She said that for the July 15th date that she wouldn't accept the reason why she stopped shifting it is the Shell wouldn't accept responsibility for all contamination described by IDEM. It's not a cleanup action, Your Honor. It's not a remediation action. It is a contribution to corrective action costs. That is literally what he pled in his complaint. That is the purpose of the statute.
But it can't be the case, to take Judge Cannelli's example, that as soon as you say we're in for a little bit, that the purpose of the statute is achieved. The purpose of the statute, I would say, is to make sure that contribution occurs in the rough proportion to responsibility for the contamination. That's certainly what the Indiana legislature had in mind, so that innocent owners like the Wickenses, who may not have done a thing except operate their shoe store for some number of years on this site, have to wind up paying for Shell's old leaky underground storage tank.
Your Honor, it's not about I'm in for a little contribution. I'm in. It's a zero-sum game, and in fact...
No, Shell was drawing the line, and I, certainly vis-a-vis the Gardner property, and excluding the possibility that the contamination there actually was underground flow from the Wickens property, which I'll call it for... I mean, I really have a lot of problem with your whole approach and your brief. Like, for us, you know, Shell is over a barrel. Shell doesn't know how to, you know, Shell's captive of all of this. Shell's a sophisticated company that has negotiated about many of these sites around the country, including in Indiana, for that matter.
Your Honor, the over-the-bell language is the judge's. I mean, the judge
and
very...
And your brief, too. In your brief, you keep saying, poor us, poor us, poor us. We're forced to settle. We're forced to do this. We're forced to do that.
I mean, Your Honor, I think it just goes back to what the purpose of this statute is. And this is not...
And would you agree that if Shell was actually 100%... If someday in the future, IDEM decides that Shell is responsible for every molecule of contamination, would you agree that Shell has to pay for all of it? I mean, putting to one side the settlement, which seems to me to take all of this off the table, but anyway.
Corrective action costs, Your Honor?
Hmm?
Of course, if they're completely responsible. But here...
You wind up saying that until the November settlement agreement, and even there, the question of attorney's fees was still open. So the district judge decides to give you about another 6 weeks to see if you can resolve attorney's fees. Turns out you can't. So she just says, look, I'm going to shut this off. Everybody's got to get serious and come to the table.
But that's a good example right there, Your Honor. November 21st of 2006, Shell says we're in for 100% of all the corrective action costs.
The statute also covers attorney's fees and corrective action costs, and the attorney's fees part was not resolved yet. You must settle cases all the time, and if it's a case that deals with attorney's fees, that's part of the settlement.
Here is, Your Honor. But, for example, we showed...
In other words, it was not fully settled as of the November date.
Well, but Your Honor, if you go back to, for example, the Court of Appeals case that was an environmental law statute that said, look, I mean, here's a case where this dealt with forcing a connection to a sewer line. If a sewer line comes close enough to your property, you have to connect to it. There is a fee-shifting provision in the environmental laws that says that if we have to force a connection and take you to court, we get the money.
Yeah, I remember the case.
Okay, well, here's a situation where the issue where these folks, they said, look, if you guys volunteer to connect to this sewer, we'll give you a reduced connection charge. But, oh, by the way, we'd also like some temporary and permanent easements. So early on, they agreed, consistent with what Shell did here, that, look, we'll go ahead and connect to the sewer
Shell
line.
Shell never said here, unlike in that case, we will pay all remediation costs.
And, Your Honor, that is not a contribution claim.
It could be if you're 100% responsible.
It is, Your Honor, but if
the district court judge finally says, you know, okay, there is finally a settlement, and I'm going to shut off the accrual of fees since it turns out you really can't resolve the attorney's fees tail on this settlement dog, and so that's when the district judge announces a standstill.
Well, but Your Honor, the plain language of the statute, Your Honor, doesn't support 100% contribution. It doesn't say that.
It doesn't say you can't do it either.
But, if Your Honor, if you look at Indiana Supreme Court authority that interprets this statute, it talks about, it says, in fact, Justice Bohm said that a contribution, and this is in the Shell case, is unknown in law, at least to this writer. But I know this. It means a sharing of liability.
Correct. And if somebody has 0% responsibility, then they should share 0%.
But, Your Honor, we're not there yet. We're not even close to...
You settled the underlying question, and so you are there. You are only talking about the attorney's fees that were reasonably accrued to get to that settlement. And actually, I would like to throw a different thought out at you dealing with your other issue. It is true that at the outset, the plaintiffs did not disclose the role of employers' insurance. And disclosure of insurance policies that may have a bearing are part of the mandatory disclosures under Rule 26 in federal court. But I'm having trouble figuring out how that nondisclosure actually prejudices you, because if Shell had known that there was a deep pocket litigating on the other side, it might have thought that the litigation was going to go on for years. It might have been willing to offer a better settlement, knowing that it couldn't just outweigh the Wickenses. So I'm not sure how it cuts, and it seems to me discovery violations are another thing that lie within the discretion of the district court as to how to sanction them.
Your Honor, I'll quickly answer and then take it up on rebuttal also. But there's no doubt, because of several statements that Mr. Scheer made, both in his brief and in his supplemental disclosure, which was untrue when he said that my clients are incurring extensive legal expenses.
They were incurring some expenses. It just wasn't 100%, to go back to your
point. Your Honor, I believe that the answer is to that is they were out $6,000, which is a lot of money to some people, but that employers have paid over $500,000 in corrective action costs and attorney's fees, and nobody had that was never forthcoming. Now, here's the deal. We're talking about an amount of a fee award. We know that it was important to the judge, because before she heard a hearing on the underlying fee award, the briefing, she said, here are the five questions that
and
I want.
We know in the end it wasn't that important to her, because it's eventually brought to her attention.
Your Honor, the end result does not match up with the language. I mean, she could not have been more critical of employers. In fact, here's what she said. Employers' presence and, quote, passivity contributed to the run-up of fees and cost by Scheer and Hydrocheck, not to mention the prolongation of this dispute. We're here on a $500,000 fee award because of that. She found that. She specifically asked him, what is the fee arrangement between the plaintiffs, their attorneys, and Hydrocheck? He never told them that he had this undisclosed funding source that was paying for everything.
Is there somewhere in Judge Barker's decision a finding that what you just read there contributed to the run-up of the litigation costs before the cutoff point that she found in January 2007.
She's talking about the whole entire lawsuit.
How do you know that?
Well, if you read the context of what she was talking about.
Well, but if you read the context of what she's talking about, the end result is she basically says it wouldn't have made a difference in her decision. So
Your Honor, if you look at her order, she doesn't cite she was trying to tackle so many things at that point. She doesn't. There's not even a citation to a Rule 60 case in there. And it's sort of just a conclusion at the end. And I think for a remarkable job that she did, for all that she was asked to do at the end, it was almost like it was just judicial fatigue. I mean, at that point, she was just like, I've said what I've said. Let's just be done with it. But there's no doubt. In fact,
I've been judicially fatigued before, but that's pretty speculative.
Well, Your Honor, might be, but there has to be some sort of ramifications. If somebody pointedly says, what is the fee arrangement between you, your consultant, and your clients, and you never bother to mention that somebody is paying for all of this, there has to be some repercussion for that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Scheer?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Scheer. I was attorney for the plaintiffs, Pam and Dan Wickens, in the district court. And I'm here today as attorney and in my own name as real party in interest.
So, Mr. Scheer, why didn't you ever mention the employer's role given the mandatory nature of the disclosure of insurance arrangements?
Your Honor, under the words of Rule 26, let me start there, which you mentioned for the mandatory disclosures. The actual wording of Rule 26 says that an insurer must be disclosed who may be responsible for payment of the judgment. There's actually no question here that, under the literal words of Rule 26, this insurer doesn't come within that scope. This insurer was not responsible for payment of any judgment in the case. And Judge Barker specifically found that there was no obligation during the course of discovery up until that May 12, 2008 hearing where we had 15 minutes of argument. There was no...
What kind of policy was this? I mean, surely they might... I mean, weren't they brought in part because maybe the Wickenses would have been responsible for remediating some of the contamination?
This is a standard CGL, commercial general liability policy. It was issued decades after station had closed.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
Depends
on what the policy says.
Yeah. But there is no sense in which a judgment in these proceedings would have been something that employer's insurance would have been obligated to pay.
So there was no possibility of any kind of a judgment or an obligation back against the Wickenses in this case. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, certainly. In this case, the Wickens are the plaintiffs.
Right.
We could obtain...
So then there was no counterclaim?
Nothing, certainly nothing meaningful.
What does that mean?
it means if there was, it was such a small issue, I don't even remember it.
All right.
But it sounds like the whole thrust of Shell's argument is that perhaps the Wickenses were, in fact, responsible for some of this contamination from these fuel oil tanks or whatever it was that they had, and thus perhaps the Wickenses might have had to contribute to the remediation. You're close to this line. I mean, it really seems to me that when the district judge is asking you for fee arrangements, I'm not going to go so far as to say it necessarily has to be characterized as dissembling, but it's less than full disclosure.
And that did not come until that May 12, 2008 hearing, quite late in the process. She issued a written order that talked about fee arrangements that directed questions about Hydratec, but that written order was not followed at the hearing itself. We arrived at the hearing. It started hours late. She allowed only 15 minutes of argument. She raised a number of questions from the bench. There's a transcript of that hearing. None of her questions from the bench required identification of insurance as part of a full, candid answer, Your Honor, and that's why she didn't hear about it at that hearing. Because she didn't ask about it.
The question is whether it was her problem to raise that with you or whether it was, in fact, your responsibility to bring the issue up.
In that 15 minutes of argument, no, Your Honor. What the record shows is an attorney, me, not raising an issue that I sincerely believed, and the district court later agreed, was truly extraneous to the proceedings and trying to get the rest of my case out in 15 minutes conducted after 6 o'clock in the evening.
So did you ask for prejudgment interest in the district court like you're asking for it here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so did you tell Judge Barker when you asked for prejudgment interest that this insurance company had been financing the litigation, albeit at a reduced rate, so you weren't really out as much money for over a long period of time as you said you were?
No, Your Honor, but it
Why
was
not?
But it because
I mean that would seem to me to be a pretty important factor in whether somebody's entitled to prejudgment interest, which is all about whether somebody's out the time value of money. And basically Judge Barker was operating and she ruled against you for other reasons, but she was operating under the impression that you had basically financed this whole thing yourself for the whole period of time.
There's two reasons to answer your question. One is procedural. At the May 12 hearing, that 15 minutes of argument, prejudgment interest was not an issue that was discussed there. And in fact, the order that she gave said admonished counsel to tailor their presentations and not to get into all those other issues. So that's why it wasn't discussed as part of that 15 minutes, which is where she found that I should have identified it. The second answer to your question is on the merits. The contractual relationships between the insurance, my clients, and me about how any interest award is allocated between us. Well, that's a contractual issue between us.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about. What did you argue to Judge Barker to try to convince her that you were entitled to prejudgment interest? You probably argued what most people argue, which is that I've been out all this money for a long period of time. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
I'm trying to recall the exact wording of the brief.
If not
that
explicitly,
that.
Then implicitly, because that's what prejudgment interest is all about. I've been out money. I've been waiting for my money. I should be compensated for the lost time value of that money. Okay? You didn't tell Judge Barker that you really weren't out all that money. You were only out a part of it.
Well, I was out a big part. I mean, let me be clear about that. That 40% of my fees have never been paid by anybody. The 60% that Employers Insurance did contribute, that didn't come, you know, the way it's supposed to come 30 days after billing.
None of this Judge Barker knows. I guess if I was trying to decide whether to give somebody prejudgment interest, I'd sure like to know whether they had money coming in the meantime. I mean, putting aside this whole question about the 15-minute hearing, it just seems to me that it was incumbent on you to tell her it in some context at some point in time. Even if you put out the 15-minute hearing, even if you put 26A1 aside.
And on remand, Your Honor, it's certainly appropriate for the district court to consider the full set of facts. The insurance is fully identified at this point, but it needs to be applied under the correct legal standard. And Judge Barker definitely did not apply the legal standard under Rush Presbyterian or under the leading state law case, Shell Oil versus Meyer, about the presumption in favor of prejudgment interest.
Well, but we can affirm on any basis in the record, can't we, on that issue?
Well, if an incorrect legal standard has been applied, then the affirmance needs to take account of what the correct legal standard is. And again, I certainly was out a very large amount of money and continue to be so for a very extended period of time, and Employers Insurance has assigned to me. It's contractual interest in its right to that time value of money.
You lost me on the last.
Oh,
point,
sorry.
Right?
Part of your question is well, for a good chunk of the
well,
money.
What, no, the part about what they assigned to you. What did Employers
right.
assign to you?
Employers has assigned to me any rights that it had
to go get the money from Shell.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's obvious, right? Well, but that's not something that you were out because the litigation was pending a long time. That's something you were out because the judgment is on hold pending appeal.
Well, excuse me, a large portion I was personally out.
Another no, I understand portion, that. Here's my point. It boils down to this. I mean, when somebody's talking about prejudgment interest, we're talking about compensating somebody for the fact that they've had to go without any money for a long period of time. That wasn't the case with you. You did it at a reduced rate, but the rest of the fee was on the if-come. You only were going to get that if you won or if you got a settlement. So you had to make a decision at the beginning of the case that even if only the only money you got was the employer's money, that was good enough because you could have lost the case.
No, Your Honor, I did not make that kind of decision at all. I made the decision to pursue this case to win it, to have a successful result, and to obtain my standard payment.
So you're one of those people that only looks at the upside, not the downside, when you're making business judgments?
No, Your Honor, any...
Should have been on Wall Street last year.
It's a little implausible to think that you took the case on to lose it, but I think the fact is, though, that there are risks in litigation, and the other fact is that there are also harmless error concepts. There are questions of the correct legal standard, and this appears to be the district court judge's best assessment of what a reasonable level of compensation for this litigation would be. Yes, there's an entitlement to the plaintiffs, but there's not an entitlement to have a blank check filled out. There's an entitlement to a reasonable compensation, and that is, as I look at this as a whole, when you wade through this whole record, is exactly what the district court judge did.
The problem, Your Honor, is that the district court did not apply the correct legal standard in coming to that reasonableness determination.
I don't see that, really. I mean, this is a very experienced district court judge. She knows well about presumptions for prejudgment interest and things that might overcome those presumptions. Seems to me, at some point, she said things need to come to a rest, and this, as a whole, is an equitable place to leave things.
Well, actually, it's shown quite clearly, Your Honor, that the district court did not apply the correct legal standard in two ways. First, there's her repeated references more than 53 times in her main order to settlement or to offers. She's referring 53 times to settlement offers in her decision about reasonableness.
And why is that so crazy, since this is a case that was settled and she finds a time, you know, she gives you actually that extra 6 weeks or so after Shell has promised to assume responsibility not only for 100% of the past but 100% of the future. That's the third of the dates that Shell pushes as an alternative for the cutting off of fees. She decides to give you guys one last shot at seeing if you can come to an agreement on the attorney's fees portion of this. It doesn't wind up happening. So in the early January order, she just says everything's on hold. And so she's very aware that the context is settlement. It seems to me if you forbade her to use the word settlement in her order, that would be quite artificial.
Far from it, Your Honor. Absolutely, settlement needs to be considered. It needs to be considered under the legal standard of Moriarty versus Speck and Sons Funeral Home and Schott versus Rush Presbyterian. That's an objective standard. It says you look at the what was offered, and you compare it to what was ultimately obtained in the litigation.
And also what is legally obtainable, because in this part of your argument, you do lose sight of this important distinction that Shell has emphasized between the contribution that USTA gives the plaintiffs an entitlement to on the one hand, and things like the lump sum that the Wickenses get, which did improve over that course, but that's not USTA recovery. You know, they could have gotten anything from $0 to $1 million or anywhere in between, but that's different work you're doing for them, conceptually speaking.
Very much the total relief in this case, which came to $1.1 to $1.2 million, came under the USTA statute.
Well, it depends how you... Yeah, maybe if there hadn't been such a statute, this would never have started. But I think it's incumbent on us, when you look at the Indiana cases, to be more precise about what is actually USTA relief and what is ancillary relief, whether it's indemnification for people who might sue the Wickenses in the future for this, whether it's the lump sum for the payment of the value of the land, which is contaminated land, which, frankly, I suspect doesn't have much of a market value right now as long as it's contaminated, but they get this money anyway. I don't think that's USTA money.
And what I want to emphasize is the portions that very clearly are USTA relief and that came after the cutoff date. Specifically, there's no dispute here that the best estimate of the future corrective action costs to clean up this contamination. And the state law cases are very clear. USTA applies to past and future costs.
Why do you care about that once Shell has bought the land? It's not the Wickens' problem.
Oh, just because they've bought the land doesn't release the Wickens from USTA liability.
It does. Well, that's where you get into non-USTA relief, though. Shell's promised to pay 100% of the future, and Shell has bought the land, so it's not going to be the Wickens' land anymore. And to the extent somebody wants to come back to the Wickens' and say, you're a former owner of the land, you're a PRP too, Shell has made a non-USTA promise to them to indemnify.
That's precisely the point, Judge Wood. Shell committed to take sole responsibility for the corrective action costs. That commitment came August 27, 2007, 7 months after the cutoff date. There's no point before that Shell put that 100% commitment under the USTA. There's no point before that Shell put that in writing. And you've mentioned that November 2006 mediation.
Now, but I thought they were pretty clear at that point, except that the attorney's fees portion was not resolved.
Your Honor, it's not clear. And in fact, the district court's words were that there was a paucity of factual detail about what happened there. And I need to emphasize, the district court, Judge Barker, first became involved, first saw the parties in this case, first talked to us on January 9, 2007.
I said that, but frankly, the thought that a district court judge is just going to walk in cold without looking at anything in the record, without reading any of the papers, is just not an assumption I'm willing to make.
Cold, no, but unaware of what the magistrate judge Godich had.
Why would you assume that?
Because Magistrate Judge Godich told us that the district court's procedures were to have a wall of settlement where the magistrate has conduct settlement on one side of that wall and the district court judge who will resolve the case is on the other side of the wall and never becomes involved. Because I was there on January 9th and I provided in the record a detailed update to my clients about what happened on that date. And Judge Barker made it very clear that she was jumping into settlement essentially cold. And because, frankly, Your Honor, the district court, and again, this is in the record, she had a stack of papers that with motions that needed to be resolved before the trial that was set 2 weeks later, and she waved them around in a manner that said she doesn't have a decision on them, certainly, at that point. But, Your Honor, I want to respond factually about what happened about November 2006, the confidential mediation, because this goes to the written versus the unwritten offers. And we could never get from Shell a USTA commitment, even.
But you sent an email.
Exactly.
Describing what Shell had offered. So it certainly wasn't unknown to you
were
offering.
That's the point exactly. I'm trying to get this in writing. I'm trying to get it so that we can get this resolved. And so I put in writing what the magistrate judge verbally told me about what Shell verbally told him.
But Shell is now agreeing, yes, we did offer to pay 100% of past and future, that to indemnify, to do all of these things. It's in your email.
Sure.
What's the problem?
The problem is,
aside from the fact that attorney's fees aren't nailed down.
The problem is that they say it now, but they didn't say it at the time. At the time, what they did was they didn't acknowledge my email, they didn't confirm any point in it, and 2 weeks later, they sent their offer under Rule 68 that completely contradicted that email. And that's what we kept running into. Shell would say something, or it says today that it said something, but as soon as it came to trying to get it in writing from them, suddenly it was hedging and something completely different. And you see it today. You see it even now. Here at oral argument, and in their opening brief as well, Shell is still hedging about the sole responsibility.
I see exactly why the district court judge says on January 9th, okay, we're all going to take a deep breath. We're going to have a timeout. No more fees are going to accrue. No more expenses. You guys are going to sit down and either resolve this or we're going to go down a different path. So this is case management, frankly. District judges are entitled to do that.
Oh, Your Honor, district judges are entitled to manage cases, absolutely. What they're not entitled to do is suspend the legal terms of the statute.
She didn't do that. I don't know how you can accuse her of doing that.
This is how. The statute provides that there is an entitlement. That's the word in the statute.
She knows that, and she acknowledges that in her offer, but it's only an entitlement to a reasonable fee.
Absolutely.
And so she has an obligation to make sure that the fee you're asking for is reasonable.
Absolutely.
You had decided to, review all the documents in Hawaii or something, she might have thought that was an unreasonable move.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But what she did instead was prospectively, without any prior briefing, without any argument, She imposed a one-sided suspension of the terms of the statute.
And it only goes on for 2 months, as I recall. It's a fairly short.
That was.
It's not a suspension, by the way, the terms. It's a suspension of accrual of costs.
There's two things there. She could have ordered to Hydratech, for example, don't do any further work. That's case management. But it's a different thing to say, parties, you need to do additional work. And in fact,
she's making the decision that at that point, the only thing you're doing goes well beyond the purposes of the statute, that the statute is not designed to just, you know, open up the bank accounts of people. It's expensive on all sides.
And she was
For Shell, for the Wickenses, for everybody.
And she was factually mistaken. She was applying an incorrect legal standard. And she was not aware of where that stood with Magistrate Judge Godich, who just 2 weeks before had made his settlement proposal. 2 weeks before the cutoff date, Magistrate Godich says, here's the proposal I'm making. And he even called me and he said, I'm going to twist Shell's arm to make them agree with this if you'll get your clients to agree with it. And I recommended, I arm-twisted with my clients. And the Wickens accepted the magistrate judge's proposal. Shell rejected it. That's where settlement negotiations stood right at the time the cutoff date gets imposed.
Okay, but I want to go back to this suspending the operation of the statute,
yeah,
because I'm still not getting that. What was the what about the operation of the statute did Judge Barker suspend?
She suspended the entitlement to reasonable corrective action costs and reasonable attorney's fees for doing successful work under the USTA.
Well, I suppose, you know, you say tomato, I say tomato. I mean, it just seems to me that what she was doing was telling you that given where we are right now, it's not going to be reasonable for you to do that. So rather than having to fight about it later, let's just put the brakes on now and see if we can get the darn thing settled, which, by the way, ultimately worked. I mean, this happens in district courts all the time. I mean, you know that. I know it. The other lawyers in the room know it. Judges tell lawyers, you know, we're close enough to a settlement. Stop taking the depositions. Stop doing the discovery. Stop sending out the subpoenas. Stop doing all of that stuff. This doesn't strike me as all that much different from that.
Oh, it is, Your Honor. And Magistrate Judge Magnus Stinson did what you described a little later before we entered that one written agreement in August 2007. She told Hydratech, stop your work. And Hydratech stopped. And she said, I'm going to lift this order August 28th. And sure enough, August 27th, Shell came to the table and signed on. Telling us, stop work. We stop. What's impermissible is for Judge Barker to say, I'm reopening discovery. Shell is entitled to collect more data. And we need to review that. We need our person to be there to stop the problems that have happened before. What's impermissible to say there's additional work that's required. This was 2 weeks away from what was supposed to be our second trial date. She can't say there is more work that needs to be done. Here's the more work that you need to do it. But the standard is not going to be reasonableness under the statute
That's essentially what she was saying, I think. That's the way I read it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's what she was trying to do, but I don't think she actually accomplished it. And then what was supposed to be a 90 days got turned in retrospect into a permanent cutoff. And that permanent cutoff, it's very clear from her decision, she was basing it on an improper standard of evaluating the settlement offers. And the one consistent court thing that runs through her decisions is the proportionality concern, that, hey, the value of the property is this.
You mentioned that in passing a couple of times, just as kind of factual background. I don't think she had any notion that the value of this underlying parcel of land had anything to do with the attorney's fees. You certainly wouldn't have gotten the kinds of fees you got if she thought that.
Oh, Your Honor, from the very opening, her February 9, 2007 order. This is just 1 month after her first meeting with the parties. This is where she's imposing this initial timeout. She says, we are already quite concerned that the cost generated in litigating this action threatened to far exceed the value of the subject property. That's in the appendix at supplement page 66.
No, she says she mentions a couple of times, and, you know, judges can make side comments about that, but I'm saying none of her concrete actions display the slightest inclination to use a proportionality. I mean, your attorney's fees are, since this property had negative value as contaminated property, why would you get a penny of attorney's fees if she were worried about proportionality? I don't think, it's just a mistake I don't see her making.
But if it's not proportionality, and if it's not settlement, if it's not applying an incorrect standard under Moriarty, then what is it? Because there's actually a lot of facts that are not in dispute here. And the standard lodestar elements for attorney's fees, the number of hours that I work, what my actual market rates are, as billed to a dozen private clients who are identified in the record.
Nobody's arguing about that. The only argument there is about your wife's hours and why you didn't bill them perhaps as paralegal or legal assistant hours. But that's pretty much a sidelight of this, I think.
I'd like, Your Honor, you mentioned factual messiness. But I'd like to just try to emphasize that there's an awful lot of facts here that are established.
I'll let you wrap up in a sentence if you like.
The data regarding the environmental contamination, which is what the case was about, the actual work done by Hydrotech Environmental to respond to that contamination, the main lodestar elements regarding my fees, the two written offers from Shell and Magistrate Gojic's proposal, and the successful action under the USTA and the objective results achieved. And that's usually the end of the analysis under the appropriate legal standard.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Babb?
Your Honor, with regard to the timeout period, it's the reason why the judge called a timeout is because this case wasn't ready to go to trial because there really wasn't going to be anything that they could try because they were trying to figure out from the item investigation what the status of this property was and what Shell's proportional responsibility was. And so she was like, look, we're getting ready to go to trial. But I don't even know what we're going to try, really. Because if you think about it, so that's why she did what she did, and I agree it was proper for her to do it. But if you go back to the purpose of the statute, think about a typical case where you bifurcate liability and damages. She called a timeout because we have to try to figure out which one of these PRPs should pay for what. We knew it was the Wickens' parents. We knew it was Chevron that had a gas station right across the street, and we knew there were Shell USTs. Those are three potential PRPs. What do we know about Shell at that point? They said that we're in. And here's the operative rule of law that the judge identified, and this is on...
What about this reluctance to confirm Mr. Scheer's email after the November conference?
Your Honor, if you look at page of the short appendix on page 19, the only reason why she didn't stop fees shifting at that point.
Well, maybe you could answer my question. Why didn't you respond to Mr. Scheer's email after the November 21 conference and say, yes, you've accurately described
Your Honor,
the
I wasn't there.
Offer.
But I believe the reason why is because he wanted $425,000 in fees with essentially no obligation to show what they were for.
All right. So you would then agree in terms of cutoff dates that November 21st is premature?
Your Honor, it is not.
Well, you just told me there was no agreement.
Your Honor, there was no agreement on his fees. The purpose of the statute is not to give...
That's part of the statutory entitlement.
But, Your Honor, but that's not the purpose of the statute is to establish liability. That's the purpose.
A fee-shifting provision.
For fees that are reasonable.
Fee-shifting statutes.
And, Your Honor, here's what we know the Indiana law is. Here's what it says. We know in Meyer that non-USTA claims are not reimbursable regardless of how closely related those claims might be.
I understand all of that, but I thought you could have responded to Mr. Scheer's email after the November 21st conference either saying, yes, you've accurately described Shell's commitment for the remediation, or no, you haven't, or whatever. Instead, they get the great silence, and you're now telling me, well, it's because there was actually no final agreement there.
Your Honor, he wanted $35,000 in damages just for claims that had already been struck in the summary judgment proceeding, and he wanted all of his fees.
Well, in other words, there was no agreement yet.
There was no agreement yet, Your Honor. That is correct. But they had agreed to contribute 100% of the costs, which is beyond the purpose of the USTA statute.
All right. We've been through that.
And, Your Honor, I would just like to, in terms of how the nondisclosure of the insurance company. It's one of the things that the judge says, and this is on short appendix 45. She says, in short, it is implausible to think that a paying client would engage or expect its attorney to advocate for a for more or a tougher residential environmental property standards to be applied to the client's own commercial property. Now, one of the bizarre things about this case is that Shell is in early on, and they're saying, look, we'll pay for whatever our proportionate share is. But, oh, by the way, we don't really think it's that contaminated. Here is a plaintiff's attorney with an undisclosed funding source that is paying no attention whatsoever. And the reason why the corrective action costs are where they're at, and the reason why this case took on the life that it did, is because they are advocating for more contamination on that property. Now, how could that possibly make any sense? It certainly didn't make any sense to the district judge.
Maybe there are duties of candor to IDEM. I would imagine there are.
Your Honor, clearly, but that's not what the judge found out. She said, look, it's...
She makes a comment that it's not always... But once Hydrotech, as a reputable company, starts testing, they can't just, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
But it's unusual, though, Your Honor, for somebody who's suing somebody and claiming you have to clean up for the remediation. But, oh, by the way, what you're willing to clean up isn't good enough. We think it's more contaminated
because
than
they
that.
I don't want to be sued in the future as a PRP, as a former owner of the property. I mean, I guess I don't find it quite so stunning. But
Your Honor, the last thought that I would close is if on the May 8th hearing on page 145 to 147 of the transcript, the judge is talking about a golden ticket. And she says, what I think you had a golden ticket. I really do. And what keeps a lawyer from you under this statute from being reasonable? And at the end of the day, his response was, because I was making decisions on behalf of my clients and I had an investment in this case. But, Your Honor, he did not. Everything was being paid for by the insurance company. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.